The Bizarre Cast contains adult themes and explicit content. Listener discretion is advised.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to The Bizarre. And with me today, I have Basil Baz, better known to friends, family, and foes alike as Baz. And just a little bit of an introduction for you guys. He was a former US Marine captain, counterterrorism expert, CIA special operations officer, intelligent paramilitary case officer. He is a film and TV actor, and he is the founder of the Association of Recovery of Children in America and known as the patron saint of missing kids. Baz, very nice for you to be here today. It'll be great chatting with you, I'm sure. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing good. Thank you very much, Richard. It's good to be here with you.
Thank you very much. Okay, we have lots to discuss today, Baz. I usually start at the beginning. You have a fairly decorated resume, I must say. And just to start off, where were you before, I suppose, the military? What was Baz doing as a young lad?
I was raised in a very unique environment, Richard. Pretty historical environment. Raised in a good family. My parents and my sister, pretty much everything is good on this earth. My father was a Green Beret. He was a military man. And so I spent my younger years as a kid from a military family doing what most kids do with their great imagination, you know, playing football, soccer, baseball, different countries in the United States. And went to college. And then I ended up went to a junior college to play football or soccer. Thought what I wanted to do was be a professional soccer player. Was my life for a while there in my later years. And then from there, after I went to the Citadel, which is a military academy, I opted to go into the Marine Corps after that. Okay. And how I ended up there, kind of following in all the footsteps of my uncles and my father, of course.
Yeah, because, you know, people would say that the Marines are probably the greatest fighting force that ever existed. Is there a high barrier of entry for that?
Yeah, you know, quite honestly, and of course I'm prejudiced because I am a Marine, kind of once a Marine, always a Marine. They're bred differently, they're trained differently, the discipline is higher than, in my opinion, any of the conventional forces. And then, of course, from there, you have, of course, special forces, which each branch has something to do with special forces. And then, with all due fairness, those are pretty disciplined warfighters, to be honest with you. But overall, I think if you were to match conventional Army, conventional Marine Corps, Navy, and Air Force, I think Marine Corps will come out on top every single time. It's probably a reason why they have Marines guarding the White House. There's something to be said for that, you know? Yeah. We're always first to fight. We have a great history, which dates all the way back to the founding of the country, of course. Somewhat roguish, I think. Probably most Marines were a bunch of pirates before they were recruited into the Continental Army or the Navy or something. But I love them. I love them. They're fearless.
Yeah, because I must say, from the outside looking in, as the audience can tell by now, they've been listening to me for many number of episodes. I'm not an American. So from the outside looking in, the Marines are always something, and I'm sure you saw yourself as a young lad before you did join the military. There's something awesome, I suppose, is the correct word, and a lot of mystique and bravado to look up to. I suppose these days people might call it toxic masculinity, but I think it's something that might be missing from today's society that we might be able to touch on.
I don't think there's anything wrong with toxic masculinity, to be honest with you. I think men need to learn how to be men, you know, honestly.
Yeah. There's different guises. I think at the end of the day, it is masculinity. But I suppose being in the counterterrorism field, late 70s, early 80s, terrorism wasn't really a word that was on people's lips before, we'll say, 9/11. What was the world of terrorism like around that time for yourself when you were in the Marines?
Yeah, thank you, Richard. You know, you're right. It wasn't a familiar term, nor was it a very familiar type of guerrilla warfare that people were concerned about at that time. For many of us that were quickly diving into that whole arena, and of course, having to learn it quickly from a lot of strategic partners, whether that was British SAS or other people that actually had dealt with quote-unquote terrorism activity. it was an educational process for us, but it was also an educational process for people in America that just weren't getting it. They weren't buying into it. Congressmen weren't buying into it. Some of the military wasn't buying into it, particularly when you talked about taking precautionary measures, because here's this thing that's going to happen eventually, but it's invisible right now because you haven't experienced. And so for a lot of people in the country, when back in the 70s, when I would take the knowledge that I had and would talk to them about something as simple as someone hijacking an airplane, yeah, and flying into a building, which, by the way, in the 70s was discussed. We called them basically flying bombs. Yeah. Quite honestly, there were people that laughed at that. They were like, why would anybody want to do that? Who would ever think of that? That'll never happen, and on and on and on. And of course, over the years, we've watched this unfold to become true, of course. But the one thing that we really dove into about terrorism in those days was the ideology behind it. What would cause somebody to be a terrorist? Because, as you may know, even with our own history in the American Revolution, the British called us terrorists. Why? Because of the way we fought. We weren't fighting there. We were hiding behind trees and running away and enveloping all this really kind of cool stuff, you know, that helped us win that war. And so people didn't realize that you could have a woman strap bombs to her and walk in the middle of a school and do something. It would be like, how could this even happen? Why would anybody even sacrifice their lives? So teaching and training the ideology at that time for us mostly revolved around, believe it or not, radical Islamic teachings, even at that time. We dealt with South America and terrorism there, and we dealt with things in Italy, you know, with the Red Brigade, and we dealt with all these terrorist groups. But what we were seeing that was going to be like a forest on fire, so to speak, was this radical Islamic teaching kind of blanketed in a religion. And the more we kept studying it, the more we saw how dangerous it was going to be. And of course, now we're in 2000 and something, and all of that's coming true. Yeah. And I can only say I wish they had have listened then, but they weren't even listening to people like Oliver North, who was talking about Osama bin Laden at that time. You know, we just weren't invested in that type of thinking.
Yeah, definitely. I can appreciate that. And I suppose kind of being in it at that stage and sort of seeing it unfold, did that ever sort of waver not your faith, but people in the higher ups being able to deal with that, like preemptively? Or would it have changed your opinion of the hierarchy in that regard?
Yeah, I think that had they not continued to stay in the same cycle that we find ourselves in, as we do with many nations, which is just repeated offenses is what I call it, meaning something happens 15 years ago and all of a sudden the institutional knowledge just drifts away.
Yeah.
And next thing you know, security is lax, things are lax, and it happens again.
Yeah.
And it happens again and happens again, and you finally go, this is stupid. Why is this? We know what to look for, so why are we doing that?
Yeah.
You know, I think I'd be very honest with you, Richard, probably one of the smartest nations on the planet, and they've had to be smart, is actually Israel.
Yeah.
You know, they've got eyes all over the place with their citizens because of their situation. They have basically taken their vigilance, so to speak, and trained people in their country so that everybody knows what to look for. Because there's never enough police, there's never enough, in our country, never enough FBI, CIA, there's never going to be enough of anybody to protect you, which is one of the great things about America that I love, you know, is that you have the right as an American to protect yourself to some degree. All that said, if you don't know what you're looking for, you're not going to see it coming. So as you know, Richard, we have this whole border issue here in America, both Canadian, we have Mexico, and here we have the Democrats in our Congress, which are, to be quite frank with the world and your listeners, pretty much socialist.
Yeah.
I mean, I boldly say that because it's true. And that in itself is a mystery, is how did we end up with basically a treasonous group of people that are doing everything they can that goes strictly against the Constitution, it goes against good standards, it goes against anything, And then we have a president that's trying to show them, look, this is happening at the border, and they're pretending it's not. So at our border, we've got people filtering in right and left. We have ISIS already in the country.
Yeah.
It's just not immigrants. We've got the cartel using the illegal immigration situation so that they can bring in more drugs from another place. We've got MS-13, one of the most ruthless gangs, you know, pretty much up from Nicaragua and that are here in America as well. And it's causing us problems right and left. And all we've got an amazing president who just says, hey, here's an answer. Let's just control it. Yeah. Let's control it. And then we've got this other group of people that are like, no, we don't want to control it. It's like, it's the dumbest thing in the world.
Yeah.
But this is America. What can I say?
Yeah, no, because I would say, again, from the outside looking in, it is a case of the social discourse now that's going on. I suppose people, they're complaining about illegal immigrants. Like, why can't you leave them in? But they're missing out on the word illegal.
You're exactly right. If that's the word, illegal. Yeah. I mean, my grandfather was an immigrant to this country. He was a legal immigrant. We have many, many. This is a country of immigrants, legal immigrants.
Yeah.
We get it. You have to have a system in place or you'll bankrupt your nation. You will break the backbone of your country. Because, well, for here's one. You'll love this. In the state of California, if it already hasn't passed within this month, they actually were going to issue free medical to illegal aliens, and the taxpayers are going to pay for it. Now, here's what's so interesting about that. Americans can't even get free medical care, and yet they're going to give it to illegal immigrants.
I know. That's rich.
It's no wonder
they're coming in droves if they're getting free healthcare.
Of course. Yeah, exactly. Free everything. But you know what free everything adds up to, Richard?
Yeah.
Social.
It does.
Socialism.
Which that's America has tried to fight. Another word for it, communism. So, yeah, it's a long history.
It is communism, and it has taken a shape in a new word called globalization.
Yeah.
Basically, gets shoved down your throat. And so, I fought during the Cold War. I know exactly what it is. And you may have, and I have friends who grew up under a socialist communist system, mm-hmm. and they'll be the first ones to tell you it's the worst thing you could ever hope for in your country.
Obviously I do a bit of traveling. I'm down in Australia. I'm an Irishman. I have been to the, I suppose, where is it now, Croatia, that used to be part of Yugoslavia. The people in the city, the main hubs, would tell you communism was fantastic because the hubs got everything. Go to the satellite regions and it was absolute misery. I had a professor in college who is Russian, and she grew up under the Soviet era, and she was telling me it was absolutely miserable. Her grandparents were on the farms, and depending on the cycle, depending on the regime, they'd either kill all the crops, grow too many crops, everything was rotting, nothing was regimented properly. It was just the state. So
yeah,
it is terrible, and I think it isn't something that should be repeated because it's never worked. All these nations, there's no such thing as a socialist dream. It's never worked and never will work. So that's my two cents on that.
You're exactly right. You know, it's funny, but you're so right. It doesn't work, and
it can't work. It's human greed at the center of it. You're not gonna bash that out of people. So going from Marine then, recruited, I don't know how it works. Maybe you can shed some light. Is it you get recruited as a spy? Or how do you get into CIA, or is that a trade secret?
No, you know what's interesting? I was actually, it's a kind of a funny story. I was actually at the National War College attending a counterterrorism conference in Washington, D.C., and everybody was pontificating on, you know, what they knew about terrorism. And quite frankly, there were few that knew anything about it, but they were great speakers. They had not been downrange. They probably had never kicked a door in their life. They probably never tracked a terrorist around the world, you know, but they're great speakers. I turned to look behind me, and there was a couple of guys in suits with big old badges that said CIA. And I thought, that's really strange, because, you know, you think CIA, that's their, like, you don't know who they are. They're invisible. Yeah. And they certainly aren't going to wear a badge.
They were the recruiters.
There were some recruiters, right? So it was really funny. I was at my coffee break. Well, it's funny. I was sitting there and I was thinking, you know, they're so, you know, CIA guys have been called spooks before. And, you know, they just kind of vanish. And I thought, oh, yeah, this is going to be great. I'm going to turn around again at the break and they're going to be gone, right? Never were there at all. Yeah. And so sure enough, we get to the break and I turn around and guess what? They're gone. Like I thought. I thought, wow, that was crazy. So I go out to get a cup of coffee and I'm standing there and one of those guys walks up to me and I can give you his first name. His first name was John. And he said, Captain Boss, he goes, I'm John so-and-so and I was just wondering, how would you like to do God's work? And I didn't know what he was talking about. I was like,
yeah,
this guy from like recruiting from a Bible college or something, or what's he talking about, you know?
Yeah.
Well, it was a term that the agency used. And he introduced himself, and I still thought that was a bit peculiar because I didn't know anything about the agency, and I didn't know there was overt status or covert status. And he had a little conversation with me, and he said they knew who I was, you know, and they would be in touch.
Yeah.
And then they left. And about 3 days later, I got a little note on my desk where I was working at Quantico at the Marine Corps base there. Yeah. And it said, I want you to go see Colonel Dorman.
Yeah.
At this building. So I didn't know what that was about. So I went, and you have to understand something. In the Marine Corps, you know everything's pretty spit and polish, right, Richard?
Of course.
Yeah. So I go to this building, and it is everything but spit and polish.
Okay.
The paint's falling off the building. The grass is all grown up. It looks like it needs to be torn down. And I'm thinking, I'm not sure I'm in the right place. I knock on the door, and this lady, a civilian, answers the door, and she says, Captain Boz, we've been expecting you. Please come in. So I come in, and so the inside of the building is plush.
Yeah, I mean, pristine. Yeah.
Oh, it's incredible, you know. So she says, Colonel Dorman's expecting you. And so I walk in to this really interesting office. It's plush. And I'm staring at this picture of this leather chair. It's facing away from me. And I can see the top of somebody's head, this like silver-haired crew cut, and a trail of cigar smoke coming up in the air. And he swivels around, and now I'm looking at this blue-eyed, steel-jawed colonel of a Marine.
Yeah.
And he looks at me and he says, Captain Boz, I understand the CIA's been in touch with you. Now I'm taken back because I didn't tell anybody about this meeting, right?
Yeah.
Of those two guys. And I didn't say anything. And he just looks at me and he kind of grins and he takes his fire stick, the cigar, and he puts it down. And he says, Captain Boz, he goes, I can see that you're not really sure why I'm asking you this question. He says, so maybe I had to give you a little background. He goes, do you remember 19 so-and-so, Beirut, Lebanon? There's a naval attaché coming out of the Hilton Hotel, and he gets gunned down by terrorists who drive by in a car. Mm. And I had remembered that incident. It was in the newspaper, and I said, yes, sir, I do remember that. He goes, yes, but did you hear the rest of the story? And I said, no, sir, I did not. He goes, that Marine, he goes, that man got up, pulled his Uzi out of his briefcase, stood in the middle of the road when they came back, and he killed all four of those son of a guns.
Wow.
And then walked back in the Hilton Hotel, sat down, and said, could someone get me a doctor? And he goes, Captain Boz, that's why I always stay at the Hilton Hotel. Following the story, and he goes, and he looks at me, and he knows I'm not getting it. I've got piecing it together, and he says, I was at Naval Attaché. He goes, I worked for the CIA. And I'm here to ask you, would you like to work for the CIA? And I said, well, sir, that's a lot to think about. And I said, I'm not really sure. And he said, well, look, you think about it, and you get back in touch with me and let me know. He goes, look, you're a captain in the Marine Corps. He goes, you're a Citadel graduate. You'll probably get a star. You'll be a general in the Marine Corps one day. He goes, but he says, you join the CIA. He goes, you'll get to see the world.
Yeah.
Think about it. So I said, thank you, sir. I started to walk out, and I stopped at his door, and I turned around, and he was staring at me. And I looked at him, and I said, sir, what would you do if you were me? Richard, he swivels around back in the chair, and I'm looking at the same picture that I looked at when I walked in. the back of the leather chair, the top of his head, and then that trail of cigar smoke just going up into the air. And all I hear him say was, "Why, I would join the CIA, boy." I walked out. 2 weeks later, I was out of the Marine Corps. They helped me disappear just great. They took my file, they cleaned it up, and I ended up in special operations over at SAD, Special Activities Division, which was known as SOG, which used to be, which was Special Operations Group, a long time ago, known as something like, I don't remember what, Special Activity, I don't remember. I can't remember back in the old days. And I blossomed in a career full of some of the most amazing patriots I could have ever known in my entire life that were just the unselfish warfighters that many died, many are still alive, served their nation as the president's secret hand, and saving most Americans from some terrible, terrible destruction that most Americans will never know about. Yeah. Which sometimes is one of the things that infuriates me when I see liberals here in the country, you know, that think they got somewhere on their own and they take advantage of our system, whether it's our judicial or legislative system, and they have absolutely no idea the only reason they are still breathing is because some small team of patriots someplace stopped some nuclear device from destroying like 2/3 of the United States.
Yeah.
Stories that we'll never be able to talk about, but I can guarantee all your listeners and people in America that our destruction has been many, many times altered because people have sacrificed their lives for it, you know.
Yeah, yeah. No,
That was how I ended up in the CIA, you know.
Yeah, I can definitely appreciate that because I was hearing during the week, actually, as it happens, about the CIA, that to get things done, you have three options. There's diplomacy, war, and then the CIA. Would that be true?
Yeah, yeah, probably. And it probably wasn't in the last two administrations, but way back during Bill Casey's days, it was exactly true. The agency always being known, as I mentioned, as the president's secret hand, so to speak.
Yeah.
I think that most people in the United States and some in the agency now will agree to me that Brennan was the worst thing that ever happened to the CIA, that Obama was the worst thing that ever happened to the CIA. They went in and they started what was called a reorganization program.
Okay.
And it wasn't. It was mostly a dismantling. And I've had very frank talks with people that have retired from the agency, and they will be the first ones to say that we were infiltrated four levels down by Obama's foot soldiers, liberals, people that weren't here to become spies, so to speak, but were here more to kind of dismantle and destroy things with liberalism and stuff. There was a time when the agency, that's what they did. They didn't get involved in politics. You just did your job, which is a spy, which is collect intelligence, and you didn't influence policy. You just delivered, and of course, Congress made policy. You know, but the last couple of administrations, probably starting all the way back to the Clinton administration, there has been so much corruption and disappointment within the ranks that I would say probably the last great spies, and probably all started to their retirement here within the last 5 years, to be honest with you.
Okay.
So I don't know what the agency is going to be like in the future.
Yeah.
You know, hopefully the new DCI, Gina. Hopefully, she did say, I heard she said she wants to get it back to where it used to be. And I hope by the grace of God she does, because the CIA has, for many, many years, has been that last option of security for us.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah. No, it's good to know that, like, it becomes a bit of a joke, but to say that America is the world police, but it really is, because you got to be the top dog and you have to have the biggest stick. So I'm glad it's America right now, I must say.
Yeah. I love the country. Look, you know, people hit us for being a capitalist country, but look, you know what? If you don't like capitalism, there's about 159 other countries out there that don't do it this way. You can go there, you know.
Yeah. That's always a good point. You can just leave if you don't like it. And I suppose then, was it one of your trips abroad with the CIA that you were, I suppose, compelled, the machinations and the genesis of the Association for the Recovery of Children. Is that how that happened?
It is. It did happen in 1993. The CIA had sent a couple of number of teams in early before conventional military forces had arrived to do a number of things, assess the situation, collect intel, reopen the American embassy. They went in with some Delta Force guys attached, some Somali mercenaries, and they were able to infiltrate. And of course, you know, that was soon to be Operation Restore Hope. Because there was a civil war that had broken out between Adid and Ali Mahdi's people, and of course, in the midst of all of that, soon after, we had the Black Hawk Down incident, which they made a movie about. And I think that movie in itself kind of brought light to what was actually happening there in Mogadishu. It wasn't anything we were ever going to win, so to speak. But I can guarantee you it certainly wasn't handled properly either by the Clinton administration, and others probably to follow. But it was there in the midst of that we discovered two young girls. One was probably 10, the other was 16, dressed in blue jeans, green t-shirts, and aviator glasses, hiding in underneath some debris outside of an Italian defense position. Yeah, and it resonated with all of us, my whole team. But the dilemma was, we were spying. You know, and doing what we were supposed to be doing, tasked, and we weren't there for humanitarian reasons. And so it wasn't our job to pick them up, to save them. There was a lot of collateral damage in war zones. But all of us wrestled with it back at our safe house. And we even had discussions about it. I think a couple of the Delta guys, or Center Spike guys, excuse me, had families. They were sympathetic to any child being in danger. And it played itself out in the strangest way, because we had no place to take them, even if we wanted to do that. And if we got caught in an ambush or something, and in trying to rescue those kids, and we survived, we'd probably all lose our job, because everybody would be going, what were you doing?
Yeah.
But I remember on a given night, I was standing up on the top of my roof. And I don't know if you've ever been to Africa before, Richard, but...
I have not, for the audience wondering. I have not.
Yes. Well, in that part, I mean, if you don't believe in God, by the time you look up into a sky that's blanketed full of a billion stars, you probably will.
Yeah.
And I tell the story unashamedly, but I was kind of fed up with everything I had seen over the course of my life, with people dying and destruction, and it made no sense a lot. And I just said, you know, in my own little way, I said, God, why aren't you doing something about this? And Richard, I'll tell you what, as clear as you and I are talking, somebody said, I created you.
Yeah.
And I turned to look, and there was nobody there. Mm. And so I thought, okay, well, this is a little creepy. I'm not sure what that was all about. And I went downstairs, and we had an agent briefing. And as one of our guys was leaving, he made a comment. He said, by the way, he goes, strangest thing. He goes, there's this lady from New York City, of all places, and she's opening up an orphanage here in Mogadishu. And then the light bulb went off in everybody's head.
Yeah,
and
that wasn't a sign. Yeah,
that was a sign. We'll go get them, and that's where we'll take them. And so over the course of the next two or three days, we went back there to try to find them. And when we went back first, there was nowhere to be found. And we thought, well, we missed our chance. They're probably dead. And as we were leaving out of the area, all of a sudden they came out from underneath someplace. And they came to us. We fed them. We had a translator with us. We took them to the orphanage. And then later we found out that their mother and their one-year-old little brother was still out there somewhere in a refugee camp. We went back out, found them, brought them back to them, reunited that family. And then when my tour was up in Mogadishu, I came back to the United States, and I just started asking about children, like, where do they go? What are we doing? how many are missing. And at that time, my friends in the FBI and other places said, we've got about 250,000 children missing from the United States. And that's like, missing, what does that mean? Well, some are runaways, some are kidnapped, and went down this whole list. And when I asked why we weren't doing something about it, everybody said, well, we have jurisdictional issues, we have budgetary constraints, we have no communication from state to state, and quite honestly, this is not a priority. We have homicides, we have terrorism, we have all this other stuff. And so out of that, I wrestled with the fact that something had to be done. And then I remembered that voice on the top of the roof that said, I created you. And I thought, you know what? If I don't do this, then who will? Yeah. And I left that and I took a stance and said, it doesn't matter if I'm the only person in the rest of the world for the rest of my life on this earth, I'm going to be that one person that's going to go help a kid, save a kid from the worst situations that they could be in because I'm qualified to do it. I mean, look, you come out of, as a tier one operator, you come out of where it's special operations, and we try never to be foolish, but I will tell you one thing about almost every operator that I know. They are fearless.
Yeah.
They're fearless, and they are willing to sacrifice, and they are smart. And if we had an army of tier one operators in the United States, I'll tell you what, every predator in this country would fear for his life because there is nowhere you could hide that we could not find you and bring justice to the situation. Mm. We just don't have that army yet, but maybe one day we'll get it.
No, hopefully. This is why I wanted to get onto you, Baz, because it's something that boils my blood knowing what goes on and what people are capable of. So it is very important. I kind of started from the back because I originally came across you in NBC's The Blacklist, which we'll touch on in a little while. But once I found out who you were behind the scenes, I was simply blown away at the great work that you are doing. But I just want to go back to actually when you had the initial incident. Do you think it was the contrast of the blue jeans and the t-shirts that kind of took you out of mission mode, that you said, hang on a second, there's collateral damage, there's civilians here? Was that a kind of a wake-up call to kind of get you out of operation mode? It took you out of, I suppose, the mantra used to be surprise, kill, vanish with the CIA. Did that sort of just take you out of mission mode, that you said there are children here and families that need to be saved?
I think I caught all of that, Richard. I will tell you that, you know, when we're downrange, it's not as emotional and it's more logical the way we operate.
Yeah,
that's what I was getting at. Very mission focused, and I think what happened for just a brief moment, something bled over into my emotions, and I thought, you know, there must be something bigger than overthrowing small governments, so to speak. I loved what I was doing, and I will tell you is that it was probably the most amazing part of my life, being a part of special operations. And so many people had given so much to me to become what I had become, a tier one operator or whatever it may be. And I didn't want all that to go to waste. And it felt like I was being prepared for something different and better, almost to some degree, as to what I was doing. If I had the ability to sneak up on a terrorist in an airplane, well, why wouldn't I have the ability to sneak up on a pedophile?
Yeah.
If I had the ability to rescue 15 people from the jungles of the Congo while it was falling apart, well, why couldn't I go in and rescue an entire orphanage around the world, you know, that was going through that? And so I started looking at all these, and for some reason in my heart, as much as I loved the CIA and special operations, and as much as I would have loved to have been there for like 30 years, 40 years, who knows, retired out of it 100 years or whatever, it was more, it felt like I was on the fast track of being trained to do something different. And I made that decision around 1996 when I could no longer, in good conscience, continue to do what I did as a spy, a paramilitary case officer, when I was kept watching and becoming more aware that children were suffering,
yeah,
even in my own country. And so what I was doing in the agency, quite honestly, felt a little selfish. And particularly in the fact that nobody, or there were a lot of people that didn't have my qualifications, and they were dropping the ball on rescuing kids. And so I said, you know what, I'm going to dedicate myself to doing this, and I'm going to do it whether anybody else does. And so, surprisingly enough, and happily surprised, tier one operators, former agency people, whoever it may be, law enforcement, whatever, people that have been downrange have many times stepped up to the plate and said, I want to help what you do, and you don't have to pay me a penny. I mean, we're all volunteer anyway. No one gets paid anything. Yeah. It's the irony of it is, and we're one of the oldest NGOs in the United States doing this since, 1993 when I got it off the ground.
Yeah.
And we are probably, we're the less funded.
Yeah.
And it's funny because in a way it's kept us pure, because what we see evolving now are all these NGOs and a lot of people coming out of the woodwork, and they have these organizations and they have these amazing marketing teams, and they literally make millions of dollars. And guess what? They pay themselves really good salaries. And when you go, how many kids did you rescue this year? One, two. It's like, what are you doing with all that money?
Yeah.
And so we've done so much for so long with so little that we can pretty much do anything with nothing.
Yeah.
And that's the way we've lived it. Now, it may not always be that way. One day, maybe some billionaires will come along that have a heart for kids and God and good things, and they'll say, hey, I want you to build an army of 4,000 operators that you can go and just put a big pinch in this thing, and we're going to align you with the Department of Justice or whatever it may be, and you're going to do the things that you do because nobody else can do them. That day may come, and we'll welcome it if it does, but as it is now, we do it because it has to be done, and we will do it at all costs, even if we pull the money from our own pockets most of the time.
Of course, yeah, no. And you are very modest because you do have 100% success rate with your operations. Does that still hold to this day?
It does. We've been really blessed. Every kid we've gone after, we've brought home. And every operation we've performed, there's been a miracle attached to it.
Yeah.
No, yeah, so I say that, Richard, because, a lot of people look at guys like us, and women too, that are in this, and they think we're all the Osama bin Laden guys.
Yeah.
They think we're all that quality, so to speak, and we are. We all come from that community, but I know at least us that sometimes we're flawed, and as good as we are with our tradecraft and everything we've done, oftentimes we get to the very end and our options are not there.
Yeah.
And quite honestly, I just get down on a knee and I just go, dear God, you know what? These kids are yours and we don't have the answer. I can't see what I need to see. It's like probably like Moses standing at the Red Sea, going, now what do I do?
Yeah. Yeah.
Being chased by a bunch of Egyptians, we're all gonna die. And so like God did for Moses, he does it for us. We call them Red Sea openings. All of a sudden something happens, and I'm glad it's that way because, you know what, quite honestly, we're not extraordinary men. We're normal guys that sometimes are given extraordinary power. That's it. And if you get too much into yourself and you think that you're that good, you're probably going to fall on your sword, and that's going to hurt bad, So I don't even like to go down that road. I just want to stay in my lane. I want to let people know, we give it 100%. We do the very best we can. And for every child that's out there, we want to let them know, if you're in a situation and we know where you are, we will come get you. We'll come rescue you. You just hold on, and that's just who we are. That's us. It's not everybody. I'm not a politician. I'm not a banker. I'm just a guy that knows that something has to be done because kids are innocent. You were a kid. I was a kid. We know what that's like. And I think that if you or your listeners or myself were in that same terrible situation of child sexual exploitation and kidnapping, every day we would hope that somebody was going to come save us. We wouldn't know who they are, but we would hold on and hope.
Of course you would, definitely. And just with the operations, then obviously the recovery of the children is the paramount importance. But how does this sort of operate? Is there like force? Are you going as an unauthorized sort of police squad? Are you apprehending pedophiles? Like, what? How could you talk us through maybe a textbook example of one of your cases?
Sure. Again, first place, we don't run any operation with all the without the legal paperwork. Yeah. And we have our attorneys take that look at that. Whether it's a non-custodial parental abduction, whether it's a kidnapping, sexual exploitation, pimps on the street that have an underage kid, whatever it may be, you know, we've already documented everything. We don't carry weapons. We're not enforcers. What we do is we try to use our tradecraft to be as stealthily, do the operation as stealthily as we can, in and out. Most of the time, we don't apprehend the perpetrators. We're not there to arrest anyone. We're there to get the kid out. And that in itself, that operation in itself, just that extraction is enough. If you have that extraction and you're trying to do something with the perpetrator, it's a little bit more stuff. The only arresting powers we have in the United States as a civilian is called citizen's arrest. And so if you see a crime in progress, you can make a citizen's arrest. Yeah. So could I legally, if I knew that was a crime happening, could I arrest that perpetrator? I could, and I could hold him there for law enforcement. But what we generally like to do is if we have a case and we know where a child's being held, we like to notify law enforcement first and give them the option of rescuing the child or taking down the child, or we'll come alongside with them and help them build that plan based on the intelligence we've had. Or in some cases, depending on the size of the town, we've even had law enforcement officers that have stood back and said, okay, you guys go do it. We know who you are. You want to go knock on the door, whatever it may be. And that's been good. In overseas cases, we are not bound by foreign law. We don't break their laws. But if it's an American being held overseas, then that American is a hostage being held overseas.
Yeah.
And my job is to bring that American home. So we don't always notify the people in that country, nor do we always notify the State Department that we're in country. We'll certainly, as we bring the child back to get a passport, we'll go to the embassy. But there's no law that requires an American traveling in a foreign country to notify the embassy of anything. They say, let us know in case you need help. But the irony of that is then most of the time when you do call the embassy and you need help, sometimes you don't get it.
Yeah.
Well, the irony with rescuing kids is that the Department of State at one time, particularly under the Hillary Clinton days and prior to that, mostly handled political and economic agendas in countries for the benefit of the United States government. And many times, if citizens, American citizens, needed help, you couldn't get it from the State Department. We have documented cases and traffic and emails coming back from people that have asked for State Department help, and the State Department literally said, we won't help you on this.
Yeah.
You know, so this is like, it's weird. So that's not everybody in the Department of State. We have a lot of good people in the Department of State. We've got great people in the Department of Justice now. It's being cleaned up. But there's some amazing, amazing people there, like Katie Sullivan, Attorney General Barr. I mean, there's some really good people up there once and for all. So when we run an operation overseas, we're quiet, we go in, we generally will extract the child and we'll get back to the American embassy with the paperwork, of course. And if they have a custodial guardian, that custodial guardian will be met there with them and they'll be processed. And if it's a child that has no parents at all, we'll get them back here and we'll coordinate with our contacts in ICE to say, we're going to be coming in, this is where we're coming in, and the child will obviously be taken care of in whatever social system we have, which is could be foster care, could be the state, could be, you know, a lot of things like that.
Okay.
And that's pretty much how we operate. We have a core staff, really great people. I have Tina Paulson as the head of the Human Trafficking Division, probably the smartest woman on the planet when it comes to that. I've watched her give her, we have a certified trafficking course we give for 3 days, and I've watched her do that course, and people that come out of that course are just so far ahead of the game when it comes to those who want to get involved in trafficking. We even have law enforcement that take the course and they go, oh my gosh, I never knew this. I never knew this and how to operate it. And then we have access to about probably 150 operators around the world. And these are people that I came to know during my intelligence days. A lot of them are former intelligence officers that are retired who would never help us with anything else, but they will help us when it comes to children, because a lot of them have children. So we will oftentimes call up and go, hey, we're coming in here, we're coming in here. We need this kind of assistance or this kind of help. And then that's just kind of how we operate.
Okay. And I have two follow-up questions with that then. How do the cases come to you? And the second tier of that would be, since funding is so limited, and I'm sure it's a really tough choice, how do you prioritize the cases that come in?
Really good point. Good question, Richard. We literally, the phone rings all day long, most of the time, with people that know our website. They've heard us through word of mouth. They will call and say, hey, I have a situation. Can I talk to you? And we'll carry on a little bit of conversation with them. But generally what we do is we ask them to put it in written form and send it to us to our address so we can have time to digest it and then get back with them to take a look at all the facts, you know, including the paperwork to make sure it's legal. I mean, we get bogus stuff as well. And sometimes we get people that, you know, don't realize that we're going to vet them, particularly when it comes to non-custodial parental abductions. Yeah. We're running background checks on both parents. Yeah, and sometimes there's a parent who's been given custody, but they're a drug addict and they've got a terrible track record, and you're wondering how in the world is this? There's no way I'm that kid back in that person's hands. So, so we do that. Law enforcement will call us up oftentimes, and churches, faith-based attorneys, sometimes family attorneys. People just meet with us, and we just get contacted on our Facebook page, just all kinds of ways. It just comes in all the time. You know, sometimes other strategic partners. Like, there's a great group of people called CERT, S-E-R-T, that's run by Rudy Gonzalez here in California. We love them to death. They're just great guys, really on the ball. And oftentimes we'll share information back and forth on things like that. And there's a lot of other organizations out there. So that's how it all comes to us. Now, how do we prioritize it? We'll take a look at all the intel. And we first assess whether we believe that child is even alive any longer. Yeah. So, example. Let's say that I get something and a child was abducted from, I don't know, Los Angeles. And the last known place was the Congo.
Yeah.
And we get a specific place where that child was. And we know a war took out place at there, you know, at one time during that time frame. And we'll do a little review to see, you know, was there any survivability there? And if not, there's a good chance that child might not even be alive.
Yeah.
We look at that. We look at our budget. Do we have the money to take five guys and put them on an airplane and get them there? And all of that comes under the umbrella of me simply sitting on the beach sometimes, or getting out on my surfboard and paddling out and sitting in the middle of the ocean and just praying about it.
Yeah.
You know, like, God, what do you want me to do with this? I mean, you got me in this. It's not something I invented. I could spend the rest of my life being on TV if I wanted, you know, that would be great.
Yeah.
But I gotta do more than that. And then once we decide if we have the financing to do that, we'll dive a little deeper into it and we'll put an operations plan together. We have some amazing technical systems that far surpass mostly what any of the US government has now. And that's the advantage of being in the civilian world. It's sad, but it is. You know, some of the US government is still using 2005 technology. We're using a different technology, staying within the law. Some of that technology, laws haven't even been written about yet of whether you can use it or not use it. And there's never an invasion of privacy. You don't have to do that kind of stuff. We just have learned to navigate the fault lines properly and learn to see what language is being spoken out there. It's kind of like the guys that kind of read the dark web now. You know, these guys are really good at ICE and the FBI and other places, and some civilian corporations that are contracted out, they know how to read the language. So we do all of that, even with open source material. And then once we put a mission together, we go out and we seek donations for it. We'll budget it out. And if we can get the money for it and we know the timeline is good, we'll launch a team and we'll go get a kid.
Excellent. Yeah, because I'd say those are quite hard conversations when you're trying to assess whether a child is going to be alive. And to this day, do you have an exact number of how many children you've recovered?
You know, I had to take a guess. It's not as many as I would like to. I think maybe now we have 130 since 1993. Sometimes a case, you know, generally on one kid can take us 2 months, 3 months, something like that. You know, I think if I had an army of 4,000 people and a lot of money to just put them all to work every single day, we probably could boast 5,000 kids a year, maybe, or something like that. But we can't. You know, there are a lot of NGOs that do boast that. But quite honestly, when we investigate that, a lot of those kids that they're rescuing they're not kidnapped. They're not abducted. They're not, you know, sometimes they're just a runaway. And what will happen is these NGOs will pick them up because they know where to find them. And then they'll claim they were being trafficked. And of course, they use that as their mechanism for propaganda, for donations and stuff. And people, oh my gosh, you know, you rescued another kid. So anytime I start seeing somebody claiming numbers like this year we got 500 kids, I'm a little suspicious, to be honest with you. Were they 500 trafficked kids? Were they being sexually exploited? And how did you get them? It's kind of like when a lot of NGOs want to make a name for themselves, they'll go to a third world country where they can basically pay for kids. Yeah. So what they'll do is they'll kind of set up a sting operation. Americans, you know, they'll pay a lot of money, and then somebody will deliver 20 kids to them.
Yeah.
And it's true. Those kids are probably going to get trafficked. And then they'll make a claim that, look, we did this operation and we rescued 20 kids. And then they leave the country. Well, you know what happens to those 20 kids generally? They go right back.
Yeah.
So did you really do anything other than just try to build credibility and a name for yourself? So I tell NGOs that are starting, I said, you want to do something? Do it here in the States. Do it here in your own backyard, because guess what? It is not that easy.
Mm, definitely. Yeah. And so, do you think maybe in a roundabout way, those sting operations are nearly fueling the trafficking?
No, I don't think they're fueling the trafficking. I think those sting operations actually, good sting operations, send a message out there to traffickers that people are active, that they're looking for them. I'll tell you what I think would take a bite out of all of it, to be very honest with you, because make no doubt about it, Richard, we're not going to stop trafficking. Not in our lifetime. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, we're not going to stop slavery in our lifetime. It's been around too long. Now, what we can do is we can take a bite out of it on our watch. We can do our best to make sure that it doesn't happen to the next generations. It's kind of like saying we're going to stop all war.
Yeah.
It's not happening. There's wars and rumors of war. But there are a couple of things that do need to be put in place in the United States. And it needs to be a consequence that is so severe that pedophiles or predators think twice about what they're doing. Right now, pimp on the street, trafficking a minor, he gets 6 years, he's lucky. Maybe 7, cuts a deal, lesser charges, plea bargain, whatever it may be. You know, their defense attorneys know how to navigate the judicial system to really, so that that they can't be, justice can't be to the fullest letter of the law, so to speak, you know, apply. Mm. So I just recently, as of last week, actually, I was in Washington, D.C. at the White House.
I saw that on Twitter.
Yeah. And you saw what I was there for.
Yes, I did.
I was there to talk about exactly that, that we need to put in place a severe consequences to make people think. And I want to tell you something. I'm mission oriented. And when I was in the CIA, they said, this is your mission, accomplish it. And so you knew what it took to accomplish it, and you did it.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things I don't know about. I don't have the answer for everything, but I'm going to tell you something. I know how to stop predators.
Yeah.
And I know how to put a pinch in this. And I'll tell you what, you apply the death penalty for anybody that sexually exploits a child under the age of 18, and people start thinking twice before they do it.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
And I've talked to pedophiles and predators before, and I've said, what's the one thing that would have swayed you not to do this? And every single one has said, well, if I thought I was going to lose my life, you know, I wouldn't do that. Or yeah. I probably wouldn't do that. And I think that if we're really serious about protecting our children and we really understand that they become a commodity, that this shouldn't be a hard leap. And if it is a hard leap by people, legislators that are should pass a law like that, then it's for two reasons, in my opinion. One, just don't understand the damage that it's being done to a child. They don't understand how we murder a child without killing them, how we destroy their soul so they're never going to grow up to be an adult, you know, so to speak. That's number one. Or number two, they're complicit in the crime. And that they know that if they ever get caught, they're going to lose their life. And the question people always ask me, so do you think there are people in high places that sexually exploit children? Absolutely.
Yeah.
They're across the board. I mean, across the board. I don't care where it is. Pastors, doctors, lawyers, senators, law enforcement. I look at every one of them with a suspicious eye sometimes going, okay, which of you guys are good and which of you guys bad?
Yeah.
And interesting enough, they don't realize that we can smell it. We've been doing it for so long that I can have a conversation with somebody and I can tell you pretty much right off the bat what they got their hands in when it comes to child exploitation.
Yeah, I mean, people can't see us now, but I'm gritting my teeth at the thought of it. It really makes my blood boil. Because that was going to be my next point. Do you think that there is pushback? Because especially because you're involved in Hollywood and you're living in California and kind of the heart of it. And there is lots of stories coming out that there's like rampant pedophilia even in Hollywood. Have you actually seen much of that, or is there much merit to the stories, do you think?
There's a lot of merit to the story. We've spent years collecting intelligence on it that we could turn over to DOJ once it gets cleaned up a little bit more. But it does, and it's interesting that you would mention that. I remember I was pitching a television show not long ago about that same thing, about a guy who basically is saving children, so to speak, rescuing them. And I got pushback from a lot of people in Hollywood. And I had conversations with other people, why? And quite frankly, those people said, well, because pedophilia is rampant in Hollywood. Number one, they don't want to get caught. And a guy like you, who basically knows where all the bodies are buried, you're going to show it on TV, and it's going to lead to a lot of people probably going to jail. Well, look at Kevin Spacey. He's up on trial now for that. So I think it's uncomfortable for them, and they make excuses instead of creating a show that gets people involved in the fact that it's real. They would rather kind of stuff it underneath the rug so that part of their lifestyle to some degree never gets exposed, so to speak. And that may not be the case. They always say, well, it's too horrendous, or it's just like, excuse me, look at what's on TV right now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
See it every day, but it exists, and we're going to take a bite out of that too eventually, I'm sure.
Yeah, definitely. And I suppose in collecting my own intelligence, Baz, on yourself, I do know you're a very spiritual man. What would you say for the youths of today? Because society is sort of becoming increasingly secular, and there's sort of a spiritual bankruptcy about the place, and social discourse is at an all-time high, it seems. What would be your advice for people just to kind of get their lives back on track?
You know, I think that anybody who says that there's no God, I think they're fools. Let me tell you what. Every morning we get up, the very breath that we have belongs to the God who created us. And all the people that think they can control everything and they're so self-centered, well, control your time to die. Do that for me, okay? I believe that everybody's going to stand before their maker and will be held accountable. And we are so distracted in this world by self-serving motives, technology, what it may, all the stuff that just keeps us away from what we need to do is feed our soul. The mind, the body, and the spirit cannot be separated. And I don't know of too many people that would actually disagree with that. So we feed our mind, we feed our bodies, and oftentimes we do feed our souls, but we feed our soul with a lot of poison. You know, being in the world and not being of the world is the mark of a real warrior, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Someone that can stand on their own feet, that knows the difference between right or wrong, that has a moral line that he never crosses because he knows the difference between right or wrong, and stands unashamedly in the face of the rest of the world, which is the way it's always been, as a minority, and says, you know what? When God is with me, I'm the most powerful person in the room.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of people play at being spiritual, and I think they think they know God, but they don't have a relationship with him. It would be like you and I, Richard, knowing each other intimately as best friends or something, you know?
Yeah.
And then one day you walk down the street and you're talking about your buddy Boz that's on the blacklist, and somebody goes, oh, I know him. And you go, you do? Yeah, I see him on TV. I think he's this and this and this.
Yeah.
You would look at that person and go, well, you know of him, but you don't really know him.
Yeah.
Because
good analogy, yeah.
I had dinner with him. We hang out and play football together, whatever it may be. And I think that that's important to know. And I think that's the relationship that you have to build. And the question is, why wouldn't you? Because eventually you're going to leave here and you're going to go into eternity. And I'd rather make my peace with God here before I get there, standing at the where I'm going to be standing in front of him and trying to make all excuses why I didn't carry out his plan. I will tell you this, right? This is what I believe. A lot of people spend their entire life, especially Christians, and I can speak to this because my grandfather was a Muslim who became a Christian.
Yeah.
And they say, I'm trying to figure out what God's plan for my life is. I want to tell you something right now. God doesn't have a plan for your life. What God does is he is gracious enough to let us be a part of his great plan. Hmm. It's his plan. It's his plan. It's his planet. It's his creation. It's his stuff. And if you don't believe that, then just look up sometimes at night, just like I did when I was in Somalia. Look at the magnificent. Look at trees. Look at everything that's been created around us. The very air that we breathe by design, that we can have food and we can exist and we can love as deeply as we love, and we can establish friendships, and we can save people's lives. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And I don't know. You know, we've just been really blessed, you know, across so many spectrums, you know. And I just think that, you know, people need to be able to feed their soul.
Yeah.
That's what I think, in the right way. And there's things that you can feed that aren't the right things to feed, you know.
Of course, yeah, because just for myself personally, it's sort of finding meaning, but wholesome meaning. It's not selfish, kind of what you're doing now and everything. You're helping society, you're putting back in, you're sort of becoming essentially, and I'm sure you'd agree, like a servant of God sort of thing, that you're doing the good work. Because it's very easy just to sit back, watch TV all day, do nothing, be selfish, take. But I think it takes giving first and foremost. You know, charity is one of the pillars, I think.
I would agree with you, Richard. And you know, here's what I've learned too. When you don't walk close with the God of this universe that created you, and you think you know how to think correctly on your own, you don't. What happens is your thinking gets skewed. You start thinking like, oh, I don't know, what's an example? You start thinking like our Democrats. In Washington, you know, Democrats say you can't give a lethal injection to killers or rapists or pedophiles and school shooters, but you can give a lethal injection to an infant.
Yeah,
that seems a little messed up, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that, and I don't think God sees it that way, you know. And I think it's, excuse my French, but it's ass backwards.
Yeah,
you know, it's not the way it's supposed to be. And I think that we need to have right thinking, and I don't think that's something that we get on our own. You know, there's a thing that hopefully most of the millennials in our country will understand this. There's a thing called wisdom, and they don't know how to gain wisdom.
Yeah,
they get education. They know how to use devices and everything, but it's almost like Star Wars, the movie, you know? It's like the Force. They don't know how to get the Force.
Yeah.
And they don't know how to listen to the Force, so to speak, you know? So they know how to do everything else, but they don't know that. And wisdom, when you gain wisdom, particularly if you gain godly wisdom, I'm going to tell you what, it will shift things in your life 180 degrees.
Yeah.
And you will be loved better. You will love people deeper. You will be smarter. You'll have better judgment. You'll have better confidence. I mean, you'll have better courage. I tell people this all the time. One man or one woman with courage is a majority. But that comes from wisdom. It all comes from wisdom. And I can only hope that those who come after us finally get that and understand it and become the quote-unquote peaceful monk warriors that they're supposed to be, so to speak.
Yeah, of course. No, because I was going to say, because there's so much information out there, but in terms of wisdom, it's a journey, not a destination. You have to get there by yourself and piece it together. And I think maybe what people are missing is like a straight focus to point them in the direction. I think it's that's probably a lack of direction these days, and there's too much frivolous entertainment at people's fingertips. You know, they're not going out in the river fishing or, you know, thinking about life. I think people need to stop, because I'm guilty of it myself. When I'm walking to work, I was listening to a couple interviews you were doing, gathering my intelligence, and I'm listening, but I'm not thinking. So you're constantly just getting like bombarded. I think people need
to
kind of step away.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I think that what we're seeing now, we see more sheep than we do shepherds.
Yeah.
My dad says there's only two types of people in the world. My mom would agree. There's followers and there's leaders. Mm. And we've always had fewer leaders than we have followers. And the sad thing about the followers is they're the ones that usually get led to the slaughter.
Yeah.
So I tell all the younger people, it's like, you make up your mind now in life whether you want to be slaughtered, because eventually, if you're not a leader, that's what's going to happen. You're not going to be making the decisions in your life and other people's lives. But there's so many people that don't understand simple things like, you know what? Welfare is not a good thing. You need a work ethic.
Yeah.
You know, you need to have pride. You need to have courage. And guess what? Get rid of your self-entitlement, because guess what? You don't deserve it. You just got born into it, and you requested or you demanded as if you did something to earn it, and you haven't done anything. You know, you're whatever, you're 15 or you're 17 or you're 20 years old, and the people that came before you are the ones that put this nation in, you know, in motion, or the ones even before that, our forefathers, you know. And I believe that all those people that did great things for us, that give us these privileges, I think we should honor them with the way we live our life. And it should be humble, and it should be respectful, and it should be grateful for what we have in this nation. Not like, hey, this is mine. You know, most people, you know, they have a credit card and it's like endless money.
Yeah.
They don't ever think who's working to put the money back in the bank.
Yeah.
You know, it's all about me. It's all about me. And you stumbled on, well, you didn't stumble on the same thing. You said it, Richard, and it's so true. That whole thing about giving back, it's so important. We feel so much better when we give than when we do when we take. You know, I mean, I tell the world, say, try it sometime, try it. You know, it's not how much you give your time, give a penny, give a moment of helping someone across the street, you know, give somebody a happy day by saying good morning. Just give, and your entire day will be so much better.
Well, I'll add to that for the millennials out there. Don't post it on social media and don't tell anyone. Do it personally and see how you feel. Don't tell anyone else. Don't gloat in the act itself, I think. That's actually the most important half of that sentiment, I think.
It's true. You know, there's a group, it's an interesting group, the Knights Templars. And I don't mean the Masons. I mean the Sovereign Military Order of the Temple of Jerusalem, the real Knights Templars that still guard the temple in Jerusalem. There's a book written by one of their guys one time, and I remember this, and it was called the Silent Knight Program.
Yeah.
And the Knights Templars were to do good deeds, you know, but these were about Templars that did things and you never knew. They weren't supposed to talk about their good deeds. I mean, maybe one person knew, but that Silent Knight Program was all about that. You know, the kid that had nothing, and one day, all of a sudden, his entire college tuition showed up, you know, in his bank account. Or the mother with three kids, a single mom, and her car's broken down, and one day a car just shows up in her driveway, you know, and all of these things. And it's kind of, it's interesting. I like that because it resonates with me, because when I was in the CIA, we did everything in secret. You know, there are things we'll take to our grave. Yeah, because they're secret and some are ongoing, but they looked for the type of people that didn't want to brag about what they had done. You did it because it was for the good of the country. You were a patriot, whatever. And it's a shame there's not a program like that, what you're talking about, because how cool would it be that if we just had a program where we taught people to just do that all the time? Yep. Get used to doing a good deed and don't tell anybody about it. Nobody. Just go to your grave with it. You know? How much better would the world be?
A lot better. Well, it's something to definitely build on.
Exactly.
And I suppose we're nearly running out of time now, audience. So I need to get to maybe where people might know Baz from. We're leaving it till the end because it's really probably the least interesting about you, Baz, not to take away from all the other merits. You were on the NBC's The Blacklist, pretty much playing yourself as Baz, the paramilitary leader for Raymond Reddington, played by James Spader's little private army. How was your experience with that?
It was wonderful. I am so thankful to be able to be in the same space with James Spader and the rest of the cast, and with, of course, Michael Watkins, who was the showrunner and just an amazing director from time to time. And everybody was good to me on the show. It was great that I got to play myself. When I found out that the name of the character was Boz, I laughed because I thought that was really cool. So John Bogenkamp, the writers, and all those people, I'm grateful to them too. I think they created a very realistic show, to be honest with you. I think that show basically mirrors what's going on in the United States to some degree. It's a shame we don't have a real Red Reddington running around here doing it.
I know.
But me being on that show was actually a fluke. Michael Watkins called me up one day and said, we have this scene and I need you to come here and teach our stunt guys how to take down a warehouse and rescue somebody. And I asked Michael, I said, well, what if I just bring some real guys in? Retired, of course.
Yeah.
And said, you can do that? And I said, yeah. So one of my guys was coming from Afghanistan, one was coming from Iraq, one was coming from someplace else. And they all flew in to basically New York where we were shooting. And we ran the scene. It was easy for us. It was what we do. And then 2 weeks later, Michael called me up and he said, NBC saw you and they want to know if you would like to come back and be a co-star on the show as the head of Red Reddington's Mercenary Army. And I thought, well, that would be fun. Do I have to say anything? And he said, well, I don't know what you're going to have to say. He goes, but I said, oh, okay, great. And so I got on the show and people were so gracious. It was really natural being there. The environment and the storylines were really great. And I thought it was a really good show, to be honest with you. And people seemed to still like it. And James Spader, just a phenomenal actor. I mean, just anybody that can go the night before and learn 30 pages of dialogue and then come back the next day and just spit it out.
Oh, he is the show. He really just chews the scenery. He's brilliant.
He was very much a gentleman. I loved having those moments with him. If I can only pray that I would ever have the opportunity to work beside him on another show like that, because he was not only delightful, and I don't think James would mind me saying this, but I remember times where he would come up to me quietly and give me guidance or direction on set to make myself look better, do better, perform better, whatever it was. And here's a seasoned actor. He didn't have to do that. He could have been selfish, self-centered, and pretty much let me hang myself or fall all over myself, because I've been in the industry for 26 years, but I don't know if I claim to be a seasoned actor, so to speak. I'm just me. I'm kind of, I don't know, like Clint Eastwood and John Wayne. They were always Clint Eastwood and John Wayne, or, you know, like my dear buddy, Sam Elliott, love him to death. And he's always just Sam, you know, or, you know, all these guys that are just themselves. But Spader was generous. It was generous. Michael Watkins, great, giving me guidance afterwards. I could tell you some really funny stories that they're just hilarious. But otherwise, I was very grateful to be on that show with a lot of great people. It was really good.
Yeah, no, because truth be told, I'm ashamed to admit this because I was just giving out about people like this. But I just watched seasons 1 to 5 over the last couple of weeks. That's kind of why I reached out to you, because as we were watching the show, and I think you might laugh at this, I don't know, but as you were appearing, before your name was ever verbalized, myself and my fiance, we were just saying, oh, because you started getting into it a little bit more and more as the show went along. So he said, yeah. Oh, that's a ponytail Dembe.
That's great. I love it.
Because you were so distinct with the flowing silver ponytail. And I was like, oh, man. And then as you kept getting introduced, I was like, oh, I absolutely love Boz. And then every time you got shot or something, we're like, oh, no. Because we didn't really know your role per se, whether you'd be reoccurring. So every time you got shot or injured, it was like, is Baz going to be in the next episode? And it kept going along.
That is funny.
You were one of our favorite characters on the show, just as a reoccurring. And I did read and I did listen that you got awful flack for how you got outed from the show. Is that right?
The way you, when I got shot by Susan, you mean?
Yeah, so the way you opened the door, I heard you got lots of flack.
Yeah, you know, thanks for giving me this opportunity so that most of the people out in the world don't think I'm an idiot. they had originally written the scene, which was really dumb. I was going to, like, fall down some stairs or something, and that was it. And then Michael Watkins, I think, as I heard it, came to my rescue and said, that's the dumbest thing. Come on, give me a break. He's going to fall down some stairs and he's going to die or something. He said, we're going to have to come up with something else. So that's what they came up with. And when you're getting a paycheck, you kind of just do what they tell you to do. And I mean, I had to figure out, okay, as we were talking about it, how is it that I could look like that? I trusted Susan, or I made that one mistake that we all make in life that gets you killed. It's like, never walk on the path, but on that day you walk down the path, or, you know, on that day you didn't buckle your seatbelt, or on that day, whatever it was. Yeah. And so I thought, well, this is not going to be honorable anyway. I do it because I'm really careful. And so I think we kind of came to grips with the fact that, okay, I was going to glance down for just a moment to reach for the door, and then she was going to blow me away, which she did.
Yeah.
Yeah, I caught flack all over the place. I had special operations guys emailing me. I mean, it was like phones were ringing off the hook. They're going, you idiot. You should have known me. I mean, they were taking it like the show was like really serious, you know. They were like, no one does that. You know better than that. That's a horrible example to set for everybody. I can't believe, what were you thinking, you know?
Yeah.
The list went on and on, and I'm like, I'm not going to win this one, man. Just not going to win it.
Brilliant. No, because it was so good, because I think what was so intriguing is, you know, obviously you were around the same age as Raymond Reddington, so you're kind of piecing together this backstory of like how you might have met, and it was just a great role. I think it was really fun to watch you on screen.
It was a great role. I would have you know what, I would have loved the opportunity to have been on it longer, and for them to have actually created that backstory so that even I knew where Raymond Reddington and I came from. I made the assumption, which was a pretty good one, you know, there was that scene that was in the church when we were being surrounded.
Yeah.
And Dembe and Keyshawn and I were talking, and he said, reminds me of Kinshasa, remember? And I said, I said that to him, and he goes something like, yeah, let's hope. He didn't think it was funny, or he said, let's hope we get out of this one or something. So I assumed that the backstory was that Reddington met Dembe when he was a little boy somewhere in Africa. And so the fact that we made that comment about Kinshasa, maybe that's where I was with Reddington when Dembe was first brought on board, or a young boy, or whatever it may be. You know,
yeah.
It's not a big leap, but they never. I don't know if it ever developed, but it would have been fun to have developed that out even more. What I tell you, would have been fun is if I got my own show after that. That would really be fun, wouldn't it?
It would. It'd be great. And we barely touched on, there's another string to your ever strengthening bow. You're also an author of a good couple of books. What's your latest one coming out?
I am. I have a life coaching business on the side that I started because all of that wisdom that we talked about, people were constantly knocking on my door asking me to help them with their lives, so to speak. So I thought the best way to do that would be to be in my life coaching, just one other thing. And because I am a writer, two of the books, The Narrow View and another book called And So He Did, were books that were taken from life experiences, short reads, but have turned out to be very effective. Everybody that's read them has just, it's been explosive. They've gone, oh my gosh, I wish I had read this 20 years ago. But they're books, they're self-help books. And they're on my lifecoachboz.com or on Amazon Books. And then the one that will be out probably in a month is called Something Bigger Than Overthrowing Small Governments. And that's about how we get started with ARC and where we are. And that's a big one. That's like 580 pages full of pictures, and it's a big book. And then the next one after that I have, which is really funny, and I don't even remember. I read it and I go, did I write this? It's called The Spy's Guide. Yeah, it's called The Spy's Guide to Dating.
Yeah.
And Ken Dutton is the illustrator, and it's just hilarious. I'm either going to be the most hated man by women, or I'm going to be the most loved man among men, you know, by the time.
Yeah.
But it's a fascinating book, and I hope to get that one out here pretty soon as well.
Excellent. Perfect. Is there anything else I haven't touched on? Is there anything you'd like to talk about?
You know, there are probably some other issues. You know, I when it comes to, I think this is important. I don't mind touching on this. I'm not a politician, but I love my country. In order to kind of get us back in line where we needed to be, which was Americans, there's always a couple of things that I think people need to realize. And that is, we hear this all the time in America, Richard, about celebrating diversity. And I want to tell people this right now. That's a bunch of baloney. Diversity means divided, and divided fall. You know, what we need is unity. And I tell people here when I'm around, you're not an African American, you're not an Irish American, you're not a Chinese American, you're not a Hispanic American, you're just an American.
Mm.
And we all bleed the same. And the sooner you get on board with that, then the sooner you start celebrating your unity. When we tell people to celebrate diversity, which is a big socialist tactic, then what happens is we're saying, look at everything that's different about that person. And the human nature, when you see differences,
it's the enemy.
It doesn't die. It pushes you away. You know, it's like, well, they're not part of my club. It's instinctive.
Yep.
It doesn't mean you hate them. It's just like, you're not a part of my club. It's like soccer teams. Why do we wear different jerseys? Well, guess what? So we can distinguish the different teams, because guess what? Yeah, they're different, of course, but guess what? They're all one team.
Mm.
And I tell people, I say, look, you know, one of the things we learned about the Marine Corps, which is a pretty good fighting force, everybody's wearing the same uniform. We all got the same haircut. We celebrate our unity. Mm. And I don't care what color you are. You get down the battlefield and someone gets shot, we all bleed the same color. It's red. We're humans and we're Americans. And when we're on the battlefield as warfighters, believe it or not, we don't care where you came from. We don't care what color you are. I don't care what your accent is and everything. You're an American, and that's what matters. And that's what this country, that's what we're missing here. And we're missing it because there has been a deliberate push from globalization, which is another word for socialism and communism, to destroy the sovereignty of our nation. And right now, we have a president that many of us are very proud of. We may not like his delivery, but I'll tell you what, he's about America, and he's about our sovereignty, and he's about doing what's right. And the last administrations, we saw lies, and we're still seeing lies. I mean, heck, look, the last administration, they sent more troops and armament to arrest Roger Stone than they did to defend Benghazi. You know, we veterans, we haven't forgotten that. We're never going to forget that and everything. So, you know, what we have in our country is we have a lot of loud voices from minority groups. And because they have a big voice, everybody thinks they're the majority or they're big. And they're not. And people have got to wake up and realize in our country that there's a bigger voice. It's called We the People. And quite honestly, when we're a little more conservative, we're a little more caring. And we're a little more giving. And we're a little less self-centered. And you can hate conservatives all you want, but they're the ones out there generally feeding the poor. They're the ones that have had their kids trying to take them to church and have a moral code, a straight line. They're the first ones to give and sacrifice. Do we see that on the quote left? No, we don't see it hardly ever, you know. I mean, look, it's pretty sad. It's a pretty sad day in America when it's easier to abort an American child than it is to deport an illegal alien.
Yeah.
And that's where we've kind of gotten to some degree, you know, and I don't know. You know, I look at the millennials that we talk about who are all jumping on board, and I sometimes look at them, I go, you know what? You're talking about how bad it is here and how you want it to change into a socialist system. You know, 60 years ago, Venezuela was fourth on the World Economic Freedom Index. And today, they're 179th, I think. Yeah. And their citizens are dying of starvation. In only 10 years, Venezuela was destroyed by democratic socialism.
Yeah.
You know, so it doesn't take us rocket scientists to look up and go, wow, if that happened to them, could that happen to us? It does. So I think one of the things, if I am given the opportunity, and I appreciate it, is that it's about unifying Americans. And that's what we have to, that's what we have to get back to. You know, a socialist is basically a communist that doesn't have the power to take everything from their citizens at gunpoint. Yes.
A diplomatic communist.
Yeah, yes.
That's a good way to put it.
And that's a big issue. I don't know about where it is in Ireland and stuff. But that, you know, our guns and our right to carry guns, that's a big issue. You know, liberals feel the same way about firearms as they do about wealth. It's okay for them, but not for you.
Yeah, we have no guns in Ireland. There's guns for hunting, guns. But that's about it.
Yeah, so it's, you know, there's things that sometimes that we don't look at the practical and the common sense in front of us, you know, to find out how we really understand how things are being mapped out by people that are basically trying to throw your nation upside down. I mean, how do you walk 3,000 miles across Mexico without food or support and show up at the border 100 pounds overweight and with a cell phone?
Yeah.
Seriously? You know, somebody's paying you to do that. And it's, you know, those are common sense things that we need to look at, you know. And when we look at those things and things like, I don't know, we spend $18 billion a year on healthcare for illegal aliens, and the Democrats can't find $5 billion for border security.
Yeah.
That's something weird, you know. So, you know, the days are interesting where we are, and we just have to pay attention to those things, you know. We've got, what do they call her? AOC, Alexandria Cortez, you know.
Alexandria Cortez, yeah.
Yeah, she wants to ban cars, ban planes, give out universal income, and think socialism works. And she calls Donald Trump crazy? Come on, seriously? Yeah, we have to take a look at all of that stuff and just go, wait a minute, none of that makes sense to any of us. And look at what's being said versus what's actually taking place in the nation, you know. So anyway, I hope that people like yourself and myself can impart some wisdom on the people up and coming, at least in our nation, so that we maintain this really great country of ours. Look, if our country, if it was so bad, then why do people want to come here?
Yeah.
This is a place where you can start from ground zero and you can become something.
Yeah.
You know, sure, we have taxes. I hate them. Everybody hates them. But we pay them, but guess what? No one stops you from opening up your business here. No one kicks your door in and steals and takes you away and takes you to prison because they don't like what you're selling. It doesn't work that way. And we give more money to more nations around the world than probably any other country. So talking about the giving, you know, that you're talking about, we do it. We do it. And I think we're blessed with it, you know, greatly. So, you know, those are just things that I hope Americans start taking a, you know, look at, you know, and look, when it comes to people that criticize our president, they're not after him. Let's make that clear. They're not after him. They're after us. And he's just in their way.
Yeah. Yeah. No, because I was going to say from the outside perspective, I've had a lot of colleagues in the US. And as you were saying about the diversity and unity in the office, there was Irish Americans, there was Japanese Americans, there was Hispanic Americans, and just, I'm a non-American, obviously, but you can appreciate from your own grandfather's background, was he Lebanese? Do I have that correct?
He was Druze. Yeah, he came here in 1914.
So it clicked very clearly in my head. Anyone can be an American, and that's why people come. People, you know, they go into the ideals of what it means to be an American, and it is very important what you say about unity, that anyone can be an American, so don't put the sort of divider up, African American, Chinese American, Irish American, that you can all be Americans. I think that's something that's nearly being lost. I think people like their little social pools.
Yeah, it's not being, and if I ever end up running as a governor of some state or something, I'm going to make sure that people understand that's what I believe in. That's what I fought for, you know, and nobody has more right than veterans to speak out, because we are the ones that have kept everybody safe in this country. Pretty much we're the ones. And, you know, we don't need people coming here redefining what Americans are. We don't have a right. You know what? Our forefathers, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, all those guys, they're the ones who lost their plantations. They're the ones that lost their farms. They're the ones that bled. All of those people, those colonists, they're the ones that fought for our freedom, for us to become a nation. And they set the standard in the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. And if you don't want to follow that, and you're still calling yourself an American, you know what? You need to leave the country, because you're not an American. It's treason. And people don't even use that word anymore. They go, well, what's treason? Well, treason, yeah, exactly. It's claiming to not believe in the Constitution. It's claiming not to believe in the Declaration of Independence. It's claiming that I want to put a socialist system in place. It's claiming everything that our forefathers did not fight for, because now you want to redefine what America is, which generally speaking is about we are the world. You know, it's kind of like, I don't know, somebody told me Katy Perry. You know who Katy Perry is? Katy Perry, I heard somebody said this, and I'm not quoting her. I'm just quoting someone who told me she said this. Something about no barriers and no borders. We just all need to coexist.
Yeah.
And yet she lives in a $19 million mansion in a gated community surrounded by security. That's a bit hypocritical, you know?
It is.
This is what we have. We have a lot of people. And so I want to go back and say, why don't you tell me what it means to be an American? Well, it means honoring those that came before us. It means believing in the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and taking the same oath I took in the military to defend this country against enemies, foreign and domestic.
Perfect. Baz, I think that is a great punctuation mark to end this fantastic conversation. I'm sure we could have talked for another 5 hours. But
we could have, Richard. It's a pleasure talking with you.
So, Mr. Basil Baz, thank you very much for chatting with me today. It was an absolute pleasure speaking with you, and I hope that we can someday talk again. And where can people find you online, and how can they help support ARC and that fantastic foundation that you have?
Thank you. www.recoveryofchildren.org will take you to our website, and there's a ton of information up there. You can go to lifecoachboz.com. We'll take you into another area that I handle. And those are the two main ones right there.
Perfect.
Or you can catch it on Facebook, Association for the Recovery of Children Facebook.
Excellent. I'll pop those all in the show notes. Again, Mr. Baz, thank you very much for chatting with me. It's been a pleasure, and may we speak again. This has been Richard Martin for the Bizarre Cast, and we will see you in the next episode. Thank you for listening.
End of line.